Hello and welcome to Trigonometry. I'm Francis Foster.
I'm Constantin Kissin.
And this is a show for you if you're bored with people arguing on the internet over subjects they know nothing about. At Trigonometry, we don't pretend to be the experts, we ask the experts.
You may remember that a few months ago we had Helen Pluckrose on the show, who was one of the co-authors of the Grievance Studies papers. And I'm pleased to say today we have her co-conspirators, James Lindsay and Peter Boghossian. Welcome to Trigonometry.
Well, thank you for having us.
And just to interrupt, on a very special secret location.
Oh yeah, I forgot to say, different location. Well, here we are, a social justice. You guys have just been speaking at a social justice, Speaking Truth to Social Justice conference.
That's correct.
Yeah. We were there, we enjoyed it. Most of our audience know what social justice is about, but for anyone who doesn't, just give us a quick lowdown before we get into the meat of it. What is social justice? And what isn't that a great thing, social justice? Justice, I mean, that's a good thing, isn't it, James?
Social justice is two things at once, and that's the trick. So you have this nice thing that's about trying to overcome disenfranchisement and discrimination and racism, sexism, and so on. It's trying to make society actually more fair, to treat people with respect based on mostly their immutable characteristics, although they dip into things like class a little bit. Hopefully class is still mutable. And then you have this ideology that's gone in service to this goal and kind of just upended the thing. Like, to give you an idea of how upended it is, you can take some of, there's a fellow on Twitter who has gone through some of the biggest books of kind of the social justice academic pantheon and has seen like Judith Butler, for example, and starts listing, who does Judith Butler cite? And it's, you know, this postmodern philosopher, that postmodern philosopher, this lunatic, that lunatic. And then you have this guy, John Rawls, this philosopher who has this very famous book called Theory of Justice and really lays out what a socially just society would look like from a liberal perspective. How many times has he cited? Zero. They almost never talk about the other side of what social justice means, which is what most people think social justice means, which is what most people actually agree with and support, whether they're on the right, whether they're on the left, whether they're somewhere in the center, whether they're, you know, whatever their politics. Most people agree that a more fair society is better and something worth trying to generate. And so you got this kind of two things. Like in my talk yesterday, I pointed out that, you know, even in their own books, they admit we're doing something different than what most people think. They say, you know, we call ours critical social justice to distinguish it from mainstream standpoints. And, you know, some people call it social justice to try to tap into its true commitments, but we mean something else. So there are two things. There's this idea that society can be more fair, and then there's an ideology that claims to be working for that in a very specific way that's basically postmodernism, the philosophy of postmodernism, and grievance, as we took.
And the argument you made yesterday is that essentially they're trying to have a revolution.
Yeah, they're revolutionaries, social revolutionaries. The goal is, don't take my word for it, go look. It's like everything they write. They want to take the current system, which would be liberal systems, advanced democracies, tear down how they work, and replace them with a social justice system, which is rooted in critical theory, which is openly not liberal, anti-liberal, in fact.
And so you're saying, you're talking about anti-liberal. They are not keen on freedom of speech. They tend to see freedom of speech as a right-wing issue, or my favorite term, as a racist dog whistle. I never knew what a dog whistle was, and now all I hear are dog whistles. Yeah. Why is it the freedom of speech issue seen as right-wing to social justice people?
That's a good question. Can I linger on something, James?
Linger away, Peter. Yeah. Linger away.
So James mentioned John Rawls, who's an American philosopher. Contemporary American philosopher, recently died. The thing about John Rawls and the theory of justice is that he says that these ideas for what a just society is are rationally derivable. And he gives you experiments that you can do that are very easy to construct. You can do them in 5 minutes if you want. But the basic idea there is that every single individual is able to use, there's a univocality of reason. Excuse me, reason speaks in one voice. So we're able to rationally derive principles of social justice. I don't think that the social justice advocates with an uppercase S and J, I don't think their principles are rationally drivable at all. I don't think they're univocal. I don't think an independent, rational inquirer could come to the same principles.
They're explicitly irrational. I mean, that's all.
That's exactly right.
Explicitly irrational.
And I think that's a fundamental difference, but that leads into your question is, if the problem with speech, or the idea of speech, is that you could take this in many different directions, but one is, if your principles are not rationally derivable, then you need some way to enforce them. You need some mechanism there to pick up the slack between whatever the belief is and the reason that you have for believing that. Mm-hmm. And part of that is, you just don't allow speech, you don't allow debates. You consider debates platforming. Mm-hmm. I think Judith Butler, in an article she co-authored, called it non-consensual co-platforming. I think was the term.
It's not good. It sounds like some kind of sexual assault.
Yeah, so the idea is that one person's article was put up beside another person's article, and one was a pro and one was a con, which is
right.
Normally,
this debate.
Yeah, right? It's how we. I'm not saying it's the best way to do it, but that's the traditional way to do it. There's no violence there. And in my talk, I spoke about how they conceptualize speech as violence, which is part of the problem.
And so my girlfriend does it.
So they have mechanisms to enforce. But she doesn't actually mean speech is violence. Like, these people mean, like,
she just doesn't like him. That's all.
Okay. Yeah. Well, then maybe there's a different recipe for that. But so they have all these mechanisms. They have bias response teams. They have, and then these mechanisms act to limit not just freedom of speech, but what they're really limiting is cognitive liberty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so the way that I view it, it comes down to how you are free to pursue your truth. And in the social justice universe, there is a certain truth that is an ideologically driven truth. It is a dogma, and that's just what it is. And anything that prevents you from thinking in one way, so if we can limit speech so you won't think this way, that's a good thing.
But it's even more than that, and this is something you guys talked about. I remember we had Douglas Murray on the show about 2 or 3 weeks ago, and he was talking about, I asked him, do you feel like we live in a society where it is now dangerous to say the truth?
Yeah.
But actually what you guys were talking about is that the whole point of social justice is to erode the concept of truth.
That's correct.
As an idea at all, to teach us all that there is no such thing as truth.
That's correct.
Truth is this invention of the patriarchy, because this is who had power.
That's
and
right.
Truth is a negotiation or a combat, or a piece of combat essentially between competing power structures,
right?
So there is no truth anymore,
right,
according to the
truth. It's not quite no truth. It's the truth is relative to
subjective.
Who's saying it and why they're saying it.
Yeah.
And so truth is a contrivance of power. Mm. And truth is a political construct, is the way they see it. So there's no truth in the sense that, you know, the correspondence theory of truth, as it's called, that what we call true somehow corresponds to reality. Mm. There's no truth in that regard within this. Or, as you know, some of the more moderate, even the old postmodern thinkers like Richard Rorty put it, the truth might be out there, but we can't get it. It was kind of the idea. We're stuck in our biases, and everybody has biases, and everybody's biases are basically equally bad. So if there's truth out there, fine, but we can't get to it. So it's kind of to give them as much credit as they deserve, is that the truth is inaccessible. So all we have left are politics, which.
So if we run with that idea for a second, let me just finish this thing, Francis. And I put this question to Helen when we had her on the show. If we were living in Nazi Germany right now, there would be some scientific truths that would be the product of the power structures of the time, right? We would believe scientifically that black people are inferior.
Phrenology.
Right.
Yeah.
So is there not some truth to this idea that what we believe to be true, including scientifically, is a product of the power structures of the day? Is there not some truth to that?
So it's possible to call things scientific truths that don't qualify. What you often find, and this is kind of a norm that's breaking down, and maybe it needs to break down, I don't know, but I always think back in times like this to Carl Sagan, who's very famous, you know, he's a scientist and also a science popularizer, and unfortunately he's mostly known for being the latter, somebody who spoke about science very eloquently, wrote about science very beautifully. And Carl was not particularly well received for doing this. So within scientific communities, most scientists, I mean, you do have your arrogant git here and there, but lots of them actually. But there's this overarching kind of norm or understanding that everything that it's doing is provisional. And I mean, when I was doing physics is sort of special because physics is really hard. Anything that's not, you know, 20 or 30 years old is kind of, you know, maybe, unless it has something like 5-6 sigma confirmation levels, extremely high confirmation levels. So there's sort of this attitude that there's science, which is this very cautious, self-doubting process. And then you have kind of the image of science, or almost like some people call it scientism, is like science going too far. It's like what you would see out of a science journalist that barely understands the science. And, you know, it's like they figure out some chemical can inhibit the growth of a cancer cell or something like that in a petri dish, and the cell happened to be for like a turtle or something like that. And then they write, you know, like bananas cure cancer.
Yeah.
And say science says. Mm. So the thing that gets called science may not actually be science. Once you acknowledge that, then you can say, yeah, they had a point. Things that were recognized as carrying scientific authority and promoted as such, and still are promoted as such, can be used as tools of power because, well, you'd be a fool to argue with science. Therefore, it's right. Therefore, you have to defer to that, and that's actually kind of a power.
Yeah, and
Go ahead.
Well, I think there are a few keys here. One is the provisional nature, which Jim just talked about, and the other is there's the science, and then there's the policy implications from that science.
Right.
So there are just data points, and I just talking to Michael Shermer about this, about how if you look at global climate change, the vast majority of beliefs about global climate change fall along party lines. But that shouldn't be the case. Those are just factual. What you do about it should of course fall along party lines. So there are facts. Those facts are just, you know, is global warming anthropogenic, for example? It's a very complicated question, but we seem to have a convergence among people who have PhDs in climate science, and the answer to that is yes. And what we do about it is a different question. So, you know, the whole Nazi Germany thing, you take that as provisionally true, and then you ask what political inferences one can draw from that. And that is a function of the pre-existing ideology and the framework in which that fits.
Right. So these postmodern thinkers, you know, they were looking accurately at, well, not according to their critics at the time, that their scholarship was a bit sloppy, apparently. But we'll give them a lot of credit. We'll say they were looking fairly accurately at ways that the history of how science was being used and, of course, finding wrong answers. The idea with science, of course, is that you go from wrong answers to less wrong answers to less wrong answers. Mm-hmm. It's not that you go to right answers. It's less wrong all the way down. And so this is happening, but if the answer is just less wrong, it's still wrong. And so you had, you know, these theorists like Foucault in particular. And Michel Foucault was very interested in saying, oh, well, we thought about homosexuality this way in this era, and that was wrong, and it caused all these problems. And then we got a little bit more knowledge, and we thought about homosexuality in this other way. And, or it was also madness. He did homosexuality and madness, where it's two big things that he investigated like that. And now, you know, we thought about it this way, and it still caused all these problems. Then we thought about it this way later, and it still caused all these problems. But if you look, it's like the scale of the problems actually just keeps getting smaller. It does cause problems, but the scale of the problems is shrinking. But he doesn't say that. He says, oh, well, there were problems, and then there were still problems, and then there were still problems. So it's just a cynical read on the history of progress.
And touching on science as well, you were talking in both your speeches some very exciting developments that the social justice movement has done in science, including woke engineering.
Woke engineering.
Yeah, which I thought I'm particularly brilliant, actually, because driving over a bridge isn't exciting enough.
Yeah, you want to make it more exciting.
Yeah.
I was thinking of woke helicopters.
Yeah. So what is woke science, and how has it actually infected the scientific community?
So the idea there is that, again, who is asking the questions and for what purpose? So science asks questions, tries to answer them. Who is asking those questions and for what purpose are they asking them? That's what's at the heart of what's going on. And so it is a realignment of the commitments of who's going to get to ask the questions and what the purposes are. And their purposes are going to be social justice, emancipation, or liberation, which means following their rules. So something like woke engineering would, first of all, prioritize changing the way the engineering is taught, the way the engineering is engaged, and maybe there's something to this in some degree, so that more women are interested particularly women, would be interested in becoming engineers.
Is that not quite a sexist concept, this idea that you have to change engineering to get women to be interested
in it? Yeah, Helen Pluckrose is really keen to say that what this actually does is just continues the old sexist idea that men are the default human, and if women aren't making choices in the same proportions as men, then they must be, then something must be wrong. It used to be the view. So this is really common, is to get the same thing backwards and then kind of go the opposite direction with it. It used to be that, you know, women didn't have access or something like that, or were told that they couldn't, you know, well, you're not good at math because you're a girl kind of attitude. And now it's the system itself must be the thing that's keeping women out. Oh, we socialize women to think that they're bad at math, or we socialize women not to be interested in working with bridges and helicopters or, you know, city streets or whatever it happens to be. And if we just change how we educate people, especially women, but also boys, so that they don't get too encouraged, you know, however, then we can kind of twist the system so that more and more women will become interested. See, in other words, they think that it's this weird social forces, systemic social
forces. Blank slateism.
Right. It can't possibly be that there's some psychological difference on average, not in any specific individual.
Well, because they're all biology denialists.
Right.
Well, the evidence, I mean, the Baron Cohen studies on infants and stuff, and it's very clear.
Right.
That there are fundamental.
Yeah, that's if you value evidence.
Yeah. So on average, there seem to be some differences. And of course, now we're talking in statistics, and people freak out when you talk in statistics because they see, oh, on average, it's different. That means you think that they're different. Well, not for most people. Most people land in the overlapping zone in the middle. But when you get out on the ends, which is where you have, in particular, your high performers in any given field, who's going to become an engineer? The people who are worst at it? No, the people who are best at it. And so the highest performing people with engineering talent are likely to become engineers in many cases. And if it happens that the averages are even slightly different, the statistical bell curves, you're going to end up having more men, say, than women who are interested.
Same reason why prisons are filled with men, right? The most violent people are men, therefore that's who fills the prisons, right?
And so this approach to thinking about the world that's taken up by social justice is what's called social constructivist. Right. And so what it believes is that can't possibly be the result of anything innate to biology in men and women. That has to be the result of how society treats men and women. Mm-hmm. And so if we can just shatter society and rebuild it to where we don't treat men and women different in any way.
Yeah, we should probably linger on that because I'm sure you have a question because that's such a weird idea.
It's properly weird. But I mean, it is. It's almost like the term for it's defamiliarization. They often use that concept. It's almost like Helen describes it really well. It's like an alien came down and has never seen a sexually reproducing species before, or a sexually dimorphic species before, and is trying to, without interacting and not reading, you know, the science or anything, just watching from above, trying to figure out why is this happening. And all they can see are the social interactions. They say, oh, well, boys tend to play with trucks and Legos or whatever, and girls tend to play with these other, you know, dolls and whatever. And so clearly the parents are giving them the dolls and their grandparents are buying them this kind of toy versus that kind of toy, and they're being told this is what it's like. He's a boy. You know, there's that viral video, and I don't know if you guys watch it. If you haven't, you should watch it like 30 times where the kids or two little boys are stepping on the trash can lid and it pops up, hits them in the face, and they laugh and laugh. It's like everybody's like, boys. No, so they would look at this and say, well, someone has clearly taught those boys that violence is fun and funny. And so we have to figure out who's teaching them that. And they think that it's not just that their parents or grandparents, but it's a thing that's pervasive through all of us. We're all complicit, they say, in this system of socialization. And so basically imagine it that every possible behavior you can imagine is somehow learned by being taught that by society. There's nothing innate. We're the only animal without any kind of instinct.
Right. And if you can somehow change the institutions in society, you can create an equality of outcome.
Right. And so this isn't, let me be fair, this isn't totally crazy, because we are a species that's like hyper social, ultra social, I think is the phrase for it. So there is a lot of actual, you know, social influence in these things. And if you look at history, it's very clear you can mold and bend that. The thing is, if there's an underlying biology, which shouldn't be a controversial point, then there are also limits to how far that can be molded and bent, and that's where they cross off the rails. Almost everybody, people when we get into this conversation think, oh, well, there's the biology people, and then there's the social construction people. That's an incorrect characterization. There's the social construction people, and then there are the biology plus social constructive people, and then you have a handful of weirdos that are like, no, it's all biology. A handful of weirdos that basically nobody respects. Almost everybody that's reasonable on the topic recognizes that biology plays some influence.
Covariant.
Yeah. So socialization plays some role, and those interact somehow. And then you have these social constructionists who are like, nope.
They're the weirdos on the other end.
Yeah. They're the weirdos on the other end, but there's not a few of them. There are rather a lot of them. That's a problem.
And so we're talking about this, and, you know, and there are some merits to what they're saying, not a lot, but there's some merits. Why is it so dangerous? Why can't we just say, look, you know, if these people have these ideas, that's fine, and they're more than welcome to them, and well, it's a broad church.
You should read some of the accounts. They're charming. online, where somebody's, you know, talking about the challenges and the trials and tribulations of raising a gender-neutral child. They decide that they're going to raise their child without any reference to gender identity. They're, you know, they're always gonna, they're not gonna put them in blue or pink or whatever the different thing, trucks and toys. And they're like, why is my little girl always choosing dolls no matter how many times I buy her a truck? Or why is she putting a dress on the truck? You know, and we try not to have gendered behavior and she just keeps choosing it. What do I do? She must be picking it up from society everywhere. So when you start to, how is it so dangerous? I don't know how trying to force something on somebody that doesn't match whatever their proclivities are doesn't result in something that's at least suboptimal.
Psychologically alienating.
Like, I grew up in the southeastern U.S., which is a little bit behind the times. And so in the Bible, I don't know if you've read that book. It's an interesting book.
Hey, man, I'm from Russia. We're still living in there.
Yeah.
Biblical times.
Well, in the Bible, you may know that they mention, it's like 27 times that being left-handed is a sin. It's something that the devil, it's sinister or whatever. So I actually know one person who, because he was born left-handed, had his left hand tied to his body until he was something like 7 years old for most things, especially when he was at school or having to do writing tasks. So he had to learn how to use his right hand even though he's left-handed. And there's been some study. There's enough people that have gone through this to where there's been some studies on these people. And what you find out is that they're almost always, as adults, ambidextrous. So they can use both hands very well. The thing is that all the evidence we have points to the idea that they will never be as good with either of their hands as they would have been with their left hand if you had just leaned into what their natural proclivity was. And so there's the threat there of...
Well, you're limiting people.
Limiting people.
Yeah.
There are further threats, of course, which is that if you think that the mechanism for something is... if you have the wrong diagnosis for the disease, the prescription you give is probably going to be wrong. Mm. So if you believe that, oh, well, my child won't conform to the non-gender roles that I'm trying to force upon him or her, what do I do? It must be society. Now you have this mission. Well, I have to break society because it's perverting my child. Mm. And so at that point, you're limiting your child potentially, which you also get bent on this mission that tries to break apart the structures of society. But if the structures of society have some correlation to those same underlying problems that you're seeing in your child, you can't break them without forcing it on people. And when you start forcing it on people, all kinds of weird stuff happens.
So let me ask you this, Peter, because I found it very interesting. You talked about social justice as being a mind virus or an occult, I think you also. Was that you that said that?
Or did
you
know the virus guy.
Oh, yeah. You were the virus guy.
Yeah, we've both said the ideas before. Okay. It's a pretty obvious idea.
So here, if these...
And they said that they're a virus.
Yeah, they said
that. Oh, they said that. Okay, even more. So these ideas are dangerous, right? Let's take it as given. How has this mind virus spread so quickly and so contagiously?
Because that is a great question.
Well, this is the thing, is I'm afraid no one really talks about this, but is it that they found a way to weaponize our empathy? Is it that in a world, something that Douglas Murray would say, that in a world without God, we have found a new religion? is it this mystical thing that we have a craving for? Why is it so powerful in spreading?
That's a great question. I've thought about it quite a bit.
Thank you.
He's never going to stop banging on
it. I asked the best question there. Say this every week.
Compliment to a Russian.
Best question. No question.
One thing we should probably talk about is the substitution hypothesis. Why don't you take a stab at that and then I'll...
Oh, yeah. So that's the Douglas Murray idea. So the substitution hypothesis is this idea that, people have left traditional religion, so now they're looking to get those psychological and social needs met by a not traditional religion, in this case by politics for most people. Mm. I think that there's something to that. But not a lot to that. Because the way that normally gets approached is, well, people need meaning in their lives.
Yeah.
They're looking for meaning, and they used to find meaning in God, now they can't find meaning in God, so they're going to find meaning in social activism or whatever it happens to be, their political stuff. And I don't want to say, well, that's not it, because it's one of these things. There are multiple factors involved in why people turn to religions, if you look at the psychology of religion, and one of them is that, and that's certainly going to be an issue. I think that you're going to find more of an issue there because as our economies go increasingly towards service, those are less fulfilling jobs, and people are looking to find meaning, not so much because they lost God, but because they're losing meaning in their careers. But what I ultimately think is that the root of this is a problem of feeling out of control, which is a result of our polarization. And so we're so polarized, we're so afraid, Helen and I have called this existential polarization, that we're so afraid that the other side will get power and misuse it, that it'll cause existential threats. That's what we see this extinction rebellion going on right now, is it's extinction, no kidding. That we can't possibly let the other side have any power, and that's a crisis of feeling out of control. And so when you feel a crisis of feeling out of control, then you want to reassert control. Now we can add in another element, this our fourth companion, Mike Nana, that's doing the film about us in our work. He has this really interesting hypothesis right now that video clips work kind of like miracles in today's social media economy. So when did all of this blow up and spread so quickly? It was right after the Black Lives Matter thing blew up.
Yeah, Ferguson.
Right? So you have these videos, a minute and a half long, or a minute long, or 30 seconds long. You don't really know what happened, and then a narrative is attached to it. Turns out later, apparently, that the narrative that was spun widely was not correct.
No.
Not at all correct. And so, but this spreads like wildfire. So now you have many people who feel like society is out of control. They feel like there's probably a lot of race issues, especially after coming out of, in the United States, Obama's presidency. The conservatives today in the U.S. like to pretend that they weren't racist as hell during that. And I'm like, what? And some of them weren't. And not all of them, of course, but holy shit. I mean, they were burning black effigies. And, you know, I saw people with bumper stickers driving around where I live that said stuff like, it's called the White House for a reason. And the Confederate flag, I mean, there's Confederate flags everywhere. And they were really bad during Obama, his presidency, all through the South. So there's a lot of people who are aware that there's still this racist resentment. And that's racist resentment. There's nothing else to call it. And then all of a sudden you see racist cops. And that's the narrative that spun off of the Miracle Story video. And boom, that crisis of control just goes nuts to everybody. And all of a sudden you have these people, critical race theorists, who since the 1980s have been writing down exactly the explanation for this. Society is hidden racism. Racism never got better from Jim Crow era. It never got better even from slavery. It just kept putting on a nicer and nicer white mask. They literally call it that. So it's all still there. All the same resentment, all the same inequality, all the same racism as during slavery, Jim Crow, are still there. They just present themselves nicer. And then all of a sudden you have proof. You have this miracle video that's proof of that theory. And people very rapidly turned to the critical theory to start, people on the left in particular who are most worried about these issues, to start getting an explanation. And so these critical race theorists, and in gender you have, you know, the equivalents with queer theory, post-colonial, and just right across the board, all of these different approaches, they all of a sudden had the answers that a panicking left was looking for. And then you'd had the condition, which was that shooting in Ferguson, that was then cast as a racist event. Of course, you also had the Trayvon Martin shooting, which I don't know if that was racist or not. that one's really morally ugly. So you have this kind of series of events, and so you have lots of people all of a sudden saying, we finally have an explanation. And genuinely, I think a lot of the people on the left in general, and certainly all of the social justice reactionary type people, firmly believe that things like critical race theory and the rest of this social justice scholarship is like having discovered the germ theory of disease, but for bigotry. Mm. And so they think we now have the diagnosis and this is the thing we have to fix.
And in many ways, it's a simple solution to an incredibly complex problem in society.
It's an oversimple solution. Yeah, and that's why it won't work. I mean, it completely gets, again, it gets everything backwards. It starts by, well, we're going to reify differences in identity. We're going to make differences in identity matter more. We're going to make it more difficult for people with different races to talk to one another and find common ground because we have to be constantly aware of the eggshells or landmines you might step on when you interact across any line. Because as Robin DiAngelo tells us, racial dynamics are always present between people of different races. And the question is not, did racism manifest in the situation? It's how did racism manifest in the situation? It's assumed that the racism's there. So if we speak across any racial line, the racism's there, and it's just a matter of time or a matter of digging to discover how it actually...
Yeah, every time you do joke about me, it's because I'm brown.
Well, that's actually true.
Yeah.
And now we have created a generation of people, or almost a generation of people, who for whom everything is a problem. Everything, there's racism in every interaction, there's racism in every film, there's racism in... And if you don't see it, it's because you're a racist.
I'll give you an idea of how ridiculous this is. Last night during one of the panels, now I'm going to admit this and somebody's going to go looking for it and I'm canceled. I was sitting there kind of like this with my hands between my legs and my index finger and thumb were close together while the other three fingers were resting on the chair. And it suddenly became, I was just kind of like out of it. It's like long day. Yeah. And I suddenly realized, because I'd been holding my own finger like this and I just kind of let them fall apart. And I suddenly realized, oh no, I'm doing the okay symbol between my legs at this.
Which is now the white nationalist symbol because 4chan.
Because 4chan,
tried to troll
because
some
of
people.
Some stupid thing. Yeah. And so it's like I accidentally ended up in that somehow, and then I realized I was in it, and then I was like, we're in the middle of a panel, and all I can think about is, shit, how do I undo this smoothly? What's going to happen if somebody notices this? Mm. And it's like it's taken up... It's ridiculous. And now I'm devoting cognitive energy to this that I didn't even have to give to anything at that point. And so now multiply this by, you know, everybody that's constantly got to be aware of, frankly, stupid bullshit all the time.
Yeah.
I can't negotiate these kinds of things.
I want to add to that because there was a video, I think it was an MSNBC guy, he's a black guy, and someone made the symbol behind him. And even if it was manufactured by 4chan, what a horrible thing for that guy. He's just a guy who happens to be black, who some, can I swear on your show?
Yep.
I already did.
Some fucking asshole, some racist prick is making a symbol, even though these other idiots made the whole thing up in the meeting. Like, how horrible. He's just a guy doing his job, and then he has to deal with all this bullshit. So even though, and this is part of the problem, even though they manufactured it, if you're constantly looking for things like that, excuse me, what happens is when you're in a situation in which someone does it intentionally and there's a black guy there, like, that's obviously a problem.
That's the thing, though. It's not obviously a problem. And here's what I mean. And this is this does create a real problem. How do you know that guy wasn't just cashing in on the joke, knowing he's going to go viral? Maybe he's not. No, listen.
But even if he were.
No, because this is really freaking important. Because if it's just a troll, and everybody wants to be a troll now, because you can go viral.
Yeah.
Now we've lost the ability to tell, is this guy being racist or is he just dicking off?
No.
So now we're losing the ability to detect genuine racism where it occurs because we have to pay attention to stupid shit.
Yeah, that's certainly true. And from the book, that's certainly true. And how horrible for that guy.
I mean, what's horrible for the guy is that he has to, it's not even the symbol, or even if necessarily the guy was a racist, it's that he no longer can tell. And he has to go through this whole ordeal now. He's now the subject. This now goes viral. over something ridiculous.
Yeah, with his face in it.
And so now he has to deal with, well, was it racist? Wasn't it racist? People talking, oh my gosh. People saying, oh, that was horrible, just like Pete was doing just now. And then other people saying, oh, downplay it, kind of like I was doing just now. And it's like everything just becomes morally ambiguous. Ooh. And something that should be relatively clear and easy to pick out. Is this something racist happening or not? Sometimes it's a little ambiguous, but it's usually fairly easy. It used to be fairly easy to tell a lot of times. Now it's kind of, as you were mentioning, the dog whistles. Now it's like this universe of ambiguous dog whistles. You don't know if somebody's pulling a joke. You don't know if somebody's just being stupid. You don't know if it's genuinely racist. You don't know if it's like racist joke at the same time. It's impossible to tell. So when you destroy the ability to detect genuine racism and you make it all ambiguous, you start attacking the wrong targets. You start going after the wrong things. You start just wasting resources. Yeah. If the guy was a troll and they start wasting resources trying to fix his racism, he's having a laugh. Mm. He's just laughing the whole way through it. And that made him famous, maybe infamous, but at the same time, the whole thing is a tragedy.
The thing that bothers me about it on a broader level as well, at the level of society, is this hyper-racialization of society forces us to think in terms of race all the time.
That's the exact opposite of what you're supposed to
and
do.
That's exactly right.
I catch myself doing it. I was driving to one of our interviews a couple of weeks back, and there was a black girl waiting to cross the road, and I literally found myself thinking, I better stop and let her pass because she's black.
Correct.
Now, there is no more racist thinking than that you have to treat people differently because of their skin color.
Right.
And we've imbibed it because of all this bullshit.
Yeah, that's exactly right. They get everything backwards. And so the real threat there, Helen talks about this frequently, is that we're going to see, as a pushback continues to mount, because it is already mounting, as it continues to mount, we run a real risk now of actually resurrecting, and this is their biggest fear, resurrecting genuine racism. Mm.
That's correct.
And there, I mean, I didn't get it. I wanted to talk about it, but the conversation went away on us last night on one of the panels, so I can mention it here. There's a great talk I watched a long time ago on YouTube by Dan O'Reilly, and he's talking about, frankly, it's a psychological mechanism, and he's talking about why does Catholic confession exist? What's it for? Mm-hmm. And so psychologically, what they figured out is probably the root of that is that people sort of have on their moral calibration, they kind of have a fuck it line. You know, like, I'm trying to be a good person, but it's hard. I'm trying to be a good person. You can think about this with people trying to stick to their diet. I'm eating clean. I'm eating good. I'm not eating crap. And then you have a couple days where you travel and you had too many beers and you're eating cake and wow, that ribeye looked good, or whatever it happens to be, depending on what you're into. And you overeat and you eat badly and you try to get back on track. And eventually you cross the line and you just go bad enough and then you're off your diet completely. And this turns out to be with all moral behaviors. So you have a line where, oh, well, I'm not a good person anymore. So fuck it. I'll just not be a good person. And what Aurelia was discussing was that the discovery was that confession gets you in front of a mechanism that resets you above the line. Uh-huh. So then you're trying to be good again.
Wow.
Which is really interesting.
Yeah.
Well, here's the thing. You're a racist. You have to think in racial ways. Sooner or later, people are like, well, fuck it. I'm a racist. Mm. And then where are they going?
Yeah.
And there's no mechanism to come back to the other side.
Yeah.
There is no, the mechanism they offer is awful. So it's not like, you know, the Catholic confession, I grew up Catholic. It's not that painful. You go in there, you talk to the priest. Hopefully nothing weird happens. And then, you know, you're like, forgive
me. It's
funny
that someone else makes a pedophile joke on the show, Francis.
Yeah, yeah. You're like, forgive me, Father, for I have sinned. It has been like 2 years since I was here. You're supposed to be every 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And it's like, I know I'm going to have to say a rosary for that. Mm. Shit. And so, you know, but you do the whole thing. It's not really that difficult of a process, and boom, you're back over the line. Yeah. With this, it's you have to sign up for a lifelong commitment to soul searching and political activism.
Yeah.
And if you step out of line so much as ever, we're going to remind you of what a terrible person you are forever. So you have no way to get back over the line. So now we're in this real risk where, you know, traditional gender norms are starting to become cool again on certain parts of the... That's horrifying. Mm. And then genuine racism. You're going to get people below that fuck it line. You're like, oh, yeah, well, let's do the symbol everywhere. You know, whatever it is. Let's just go nuts. And why can't I say the N-word to whoever I want? And it's just, you really don't want to break whatever societal detente exists that keeps most people above those lines, trying to do it right, even if they don't always measure up. You really don't want lots of people to start falling below that line or decide that line doesn't matter anymore. Fuck it, okay, I'm a racist. Let's
go. So you're talking about forgiveness, really. That's what you're talking about.
Yeah, some mechanism for redemption or forgiveness. And those things I mean, if you can cancel somebody for tweets they made 20 years ago.
Even when they were a teen.
As a teenager. Mm. Like, they wrote some stupid thing when they were 16 years old or now in, like, their 30s or whatever. I guess they couldn't have written a tweet that long ago. But, you know, you get this, they uncover some diary entry or something. Oh, he wrote this or that. If you can cancel somebody for that, you deny their ability to grow, their ability to change, their ability to try to get on the right track and stay above the bad line. And you offer them no, what forgiveness is in that? There's no, oh, well, you messed up because you were a teenager. We're all stupid when we're teenagers. We all did stupid stuff when we were teenagers, whatever it is. Even me saying we all did stupid stuff when we were teenagers, somebody will clip this out of context possibly and say, oh, this is a guy with something to hide.
Well, if you're going to do that, please make it go viral for our show. Thank you very much.
Yes.
But I was going to say as well, James, you know, there's, you know, what you're talking about, but it's the impact on your mental health as well. If you were going to look through every single thing that you were saying and analyze it every single moment, I mean, that's just a fast track to getting anxiety and then an inevitable breakdown.
And not only that, that assumes that there's some kind of moral stability.
Right.
So for all you know, the moral norm could change. I mean, the moral norms have changed. I'm 53. The moral norms have changed very radically. For, give you an example, I was taught when I was a kid, and I've asked other people my age and similar experiences, that when you shook hands with a woman, you were supposed to shake, you're just supposed to offer your hand like this.
All right.
And you weren't supposed to, you know.
Ah, okay.
With a guy, there was a different kind of...
Yeah. Ah, okay.
Now, today, that could possibly be interpreted as sexist.
Right.
Right? And so, because you're treating people... you know, even something as little as a handshake. But that could be... Today, the zeitgeist is race and gender and things with an identity-level salience. But maybe tomorrow, it's either something we can't imagine. My own prediction for this has been that we'll start... If a vestige of cancel culture exists, the next... moral frontier will be factory farming. Oh, that guy ate factory farm meat, cancel him. Oh, that woman, that person. Mm. So the moral norms always change. So as I said before about the tying the left hand down, there's something that's incredibly psychologically alienating because you're not allowed to speak because of your first question about censorship. And thus, as I said in my talk, you can't form those authentic relationships because you don't know what anybody means and everybody's walking on eggshells and you're not looking at people as people. Oh, there's a black woman across the street. I have to let her go. And I catch myself doing that too. And I have to just rub that out because I'm in that milieu where I'm just constantly bombarded by that. Like, this is how we have to look. This is how we have to think of people. It's a really toxic way to think. Instead of just a person, oh, there's a black person. Oh, there's a gay person.
Right. And you talked about the way that that's anxiety inducing. And I don't know if that's by design or not, but we were just talking a few moments ago about how you can have I think that the root of this is feeling people in a crisis of control.
Yeah.
They feel out of control. We'll give them anxiety. Right. And now they feel even more out of control. And that becomes kind of a problem that just kind of keeps going. From the perspective of having studied religious psychology before getting into all of this business, that's what I really got into before I got swept up in woke land. I was learning that I got really interested in conversion mechanisms. How do people convert to a religion or a cult? How do they get induced? And the mechanism is nearly always the same, whether you do it with a child or whether you do it with some adult. With children, it's obviously much easier, is that you induce a state of vulnerability and then you give them a pathway out of the vulnerability through the ideology or the cult. So here, you give them identities to lean into. Oh, well, you have anxiety. You know, well, you're an anxious person. You're not a person with anxiety. That's something that can be treated. They'd be medicalizing it. That's the Foucauldian idea that you can't do that. So you're an anxious person. So now this is who you are. You are anxiety. And so you give them, and then, you know, the way to do that is to lean into that victimhood, just lean into it and come with us and be activists. And we can fight this problem that makes you an anxious person, even though that's the thing that's causing them to be anxious. So you give somebody you induce vulnerability, you manipulate their vulnerability, make them feel usually bad or guilty or something, and then or afraid, fear of hell, for example, you might think about, and then you give them a path out of that. Oh, well, isn't hell scary, blah, blah, blah. Well, if you just believe in Jesus, then you don't go to hell. Free pass away from that. He died for you. You don't have to go. And so it's a way to create, anytime you have this kind of emotional manipulation that taps into some path of vulnerability. Oh, have you been complicit in racism? Don't you feel guilty about that because you're white? And that means you're comfortable and you don't have to think about what it's like to be a racial minority and what they have, all the crap they have to put up with. Well, did you know that, you know, if you take up anti-racism, you know, you can do something about that. Mm-hmm. You're not allowed to do it to make yourself feel better. So it's like constantly self-flagellating. That'd be positioning yourself, or myself, I guess, as a good white if I did it. And that's verboten. You can't do that. But you give people, you say, oh, well, you can end the system that's creating this problem. All you have to do is sign up for a lifelong commitment of soul searching for how you're complicit in it and spread it to all your friends.
I think it makes apostasy more difficult.
Yeah.
Mm. Oh, sure.
Yeah. Well, we've got about 15 minutes left, and I want to end on a more positive note if we can. You guys have...
This wasn't positive?
you guys haven't spent like 2 years living in critical theory.
Right,
this is really
right.
Good.
Yeah. But we need someone to dive into it and take the hit for the rest of us to maybe look for a way out. And you guys have just written a book, which is How to Have Impossible Conversations.
That's right.
I've had a good look at it. It's a very interesting book. So chart for us some of the paths out of this, because I put it to you that the vast majority of the public intuitively agree with what we're talking about here.
The
exhausted majority.
I talked about it in my comedy show in Edinburgh Festival this year. I talked about the fact that most people are terrified to say what they think, and they are.
Yeah,
I mean,
true.
That is a fact, right? Yeah. So most people get this, but I feel like on an individual level, none of us really know what to do about it. How do we get out of it? I mean, the show we try and do is about trying to create something that gives an out to all these feelings and a solution. So tell us, how do we get out of it?
Well, the solution that I advocated yesterday is hearkening back to the Greek value of parrhesia, which means speaking truth in the face of danger, speaking boldly and speaking bluntly and speaking honestly. But before we can even do that, we need to think about how to speak to people again, because we're losing that because, as you said, I agree completely, we're walking on eggshells. People are afraid to say what's on their mind. So they need some basic tools for how to have a conversation. Mm-hmm. So for example, really listen to someone, try to figure out what they're saying. If you don't understand, ask, place the burden of understanding on yourself. Don't say, oh, that wasn't clear. Say, oh, I'm not sure I understand that. So you place the burden of understanding on yourself.
But hold on, Peter, sorry to interrupt, but I'm listening through the prism of an ordinary person, and I'm going, well, look at you.
Yeah.
You did your parahesia. You spoke the truth.
Look what happened to me.
Right.
Well,
look what happened to me. Look at what happened to us. We get called Nazis because we have conversation with people like you, right?
We're all, like me.
Yeah, right. We're all right adjacent, all this crap, right? How many people, we had a guy who was fired from his job in a supermarket because he shared a comedy routine about religion from Billy Connolly, one of the greatest comedians in the history of this country, on his Facebook. He got fired.
Okay, right? So
let's don't tell me about parahesia.
Sorry, let's take a step back. So Socrates had parahesia. They killed him. The state killed him. I mentioned Matak Malala. Mm. She was shot in the head.
You're not selling this.
being honest about the nature of the solution.
Yeah.
There's no wand that you can give and we're going to get out of this mess. This is a catastrophe.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if you look at what they do to us and the fact that you guys were painted as Nazis for talking to us.
I'm Jewish, by the way.
He's the best kind of Nazi.
That's my favorite kind.
That doesn't protect you, right?
Because
you've seen what happens to Brett Weinstein and Ben Shapiro, et cetera. That's not a prophylactic against being called
Nazi.
It's
good that you don't deny your Nazi nature, because that would be Nazi fragility, and it would...
Nazi fragility.
But we have to be honest that if you want to dig your way out of this, you're going to pay a price for this.
Right.
There's just no way. You can't sugarcoat this to people. In fact, that itself is parahesia.
We cut in on that because you're not selling it, man. That's horrible.
So that was kind of my point.
So, like, go get shot, guys.
Yeah. The argument there, before you jump in, is 400 years ago, the four of us, and there's a few more of us in this room right now, we'd all be burned at the stake, right?
Right
or
now,
have our tongues pulled out.
Right. You've lost your job.
Well, I have my job, but I've lost considerable.
Right. Yeah. You know, the whole comedy industry in this country hates us because we are right wing or whatever, right? You know, all of us have paid some price, but we're not burned at the stake.
No.
We haven't been kicked off YouTube. We can still make a living from doing this. you know, isn't it kind of all right? I mean, we can actually...
It is kind of all right, actually. Yeah. So people reach out to me with this all the time. They're like, what do I do? I'm terrified that my friends and my family, that I hear that more... I hear my the two things I hear a lot are my job and my friends and my family are going to get rid of me, one or the other. And what do I do? Well, you mentioned 400 years ago, people being burned at the stake. You know how that ended, is people getting together and having conversations like this, but not with cameras. They got together actually in small groups, often in bars where there was a lot of ambient noise or pubs or whatever, and spoke in low voices. And so what I tell people, thinking back to that, when they created the Reformation, they created liberal movements, liberalism itself, and out of those conversations, and they couldn't be overheard because it was, you know, treason to speak against the monarchy or the episcopate. And so I tell people all the time, reach out to people, pay attention on, I mean, we all have social media right now, unless you get banned from it, and pay attention. If you're small, you're not going to get banned probably unless you say something pretty ridiculous. Pay attention. Find people who are speaking out against this. Follow them. Pay attention to who interacts with them. Reach out to those people and start making your own social network. Speak in direct message behind the scenes. Get on WhatsApp, which is encrypted. You know, meet up with each other, whether it's virtually, whether it's in person, and start having the conversation so that you guys can find your feet, understand what you need to understand, realize that you're not alone, you're not crazy, there are lots of people.
That's a more hopeful message than the one I had.
Once you've found your feet, then you can start to speak with that courage.
Yes.
Because you know you have a fallback, you have a group who's going to back you up.
Yeah.
You know you're coming from a place where you've kind of figured some things out and you're not just shooting in the dark. So I tell people to do that all the time. The thing is there is safety in numbers. If more and more and more people start speaking up, then it's not as risky for any of us who are speaking up.
And there really is something to, you just have to know whose voice not to listen to.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you just have to know we are obviously not Nazis.
Yeah.
We're not even Nazi adjacent. It's ludicrous. Mm-hmm. And for someone to call you that, they kind of opt out of an adult conversation. So there's no reason we ought to listen to them.
I mean, there's already a norm on Twitter that started that if somebody, I mean, I don't necessarily advocate this, of course, but it's got some weight behind it. That if somebody has pronouns in their bio, you pretty much disregard whatever they say.
Instantly. Mm-hmm. Every time I see some vitriol, some particular nastiness, click on the profile, invariably pronouns.
And it doesn't have to be that. I mean, anybody who slings abuse at you on Twitter, do what I do. Mute them right away. They gave abuse, or they give abuse to other people. Like if you respond to me and somebody abuses you, that person's never, I'm never going to see that person again. Mm. I don't care if they're on, like you disagreed with me and they're on my side. If they sling abuse, mute, gone.
Right.
And if enough people are doing this long enough, it will create a norm to where slinging abuse isn't getting people what they want, and they'll burn themselves out, and it just won't go anywhere. So I really encourage liberal use of that as well. And then you just have to endure the fact that people are going to say, oh, you don't have conversation, blah, blah, blah. No, I won't have conversations in the wrong forum with people whose goal is to sling abuse at me. That's not a conversation.
Or,
something different.
And I'll add to that, if my golden rule is if someone has harassed me, and there's a considerable number of people, or is currently harassing me, I will not have a conversation with them. That's just not an option anymore.
But we talked about the road out of this, just to kind of finish. When we say find your feet, you know, get with people and find your feet. There are three things really that have to be done. That's what we tried to do yesterday, and each of us kind of spoke to it differently. But we've got to expose what's going on here. That's where I was talking about that the picture on the social justice box, the diversity and treat everybody with respect, doesn't match the contents, which is this kind of totalitarian ideology. That they're different. So expose that. Make it clear how. Go read some of their stuff and then share it in context. It's horrifying. People don't, like you said, most people won't agree with it once they see what it really is. You just have to get past that branding, which is really good. Second is, if you have the time and energy, maybe not everybody does, try to explain it. If you guys have a show, have people on who can explain it. If you can read a few of their books or key papers or articles that people are writing on, you know, outlets like Ariel Magazine or Quillette or whatever it happens to be, learn to explain what's going on with some of this. Again, people don't really agree with it. And then if you can, start looking for alternatives. If you care about social justice, I get asked this a lot. I care about social justice, but I don't like social justice warriors. What do I do? Look for and start articulating other ways. How can you do the right thing? Like you're saying, it's like maybe we shouldn't be thinking about race all the time. Maybe this whole thing like putting race first, maybe we should ratchet that back down. Maybe we should ignore people who tell us that we have to pay attention to that all the time. And so you want to look for, but you know, we still have to care and take people seriously. So maybe the lesson out of that is let's listen a little more than we did before. Let's take it a little more seriously, not be so quick to dismiss if that's still a problem. I'm not sure if that's even still a huge problem. Maybe it is, but fine. It's good advice in any case. And then let's investigate, but not this listen and believe crap, not shut up, your story's been told. No, we'll listen, we'll check it out, and you can help us check it out, and it's all fine. So look for alternatives that aren't just coming from this place of ideology, that the liberal approaches. So that's what Helen was talking about. Like, let's just find ways to do the thing. Let's take their complaints seriously, figure out what's real inside their complaints, and let's address those things and steal the whole thing from them.
And what advice would you give to somebody who's working in a particular industry or a company that is overtly woke?
That's a great question. Mm.
So I don't ever tell anybody
fuck
to put you guys are I don't ever advocate anybody stick out their neck if you have the ability to do it. What I often tell people when they ask me that is, oh, I have to go to this diversity training, what should I do, blah, blah, blah. I say, take notes. Take Listen. Very detailed notes. Mm. And understand exactly what they're saying. Try to get a very clear picture. If you try to challenge it on the spot, they're just going to make life difficult for you. It was no mistake that one of the papers we started to write but didn't have time to finish was things like, if you go to diversity training, we'll give you a survey. Did you like diversity training? If you say no, you have to take more diversity training. Or you get sent to diversity training, and he gets called in as a character witness, and you're like, do you think he needed diversity training? You say, no, 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 he's a great guy. It was misunderstood. Now you need diversity training. Mm-hmm. You know, so if you call it out on the spot, once this stuff's been institutionalized, you're just really causing yourself
There's nothing
trouble.
You can do at that point. Mm-hmm. In a
Take
work
notes.
Environment.
Start to understand it. Go out for drinks with your colleagues who also don't like it. Start talking.
Because they won't talk either.
I have another idea for you guys. As you know, someone recently bought all our video equipment for us. That is actually someone who works in the very work industry. So if you want to change things, Trigonometry's got a Patreon page, is all I'm saying.
Yeah, I'm saying that too. Mm. Yeah, just give them money.
Sounds good to us.
Yeah, that will solve the problem. The magic wand P is to give them money. Yeah. Okay. But no, seriously, start talking to each other, and if you challenge it directly, it's the wrong way. Start understanding it so you can explain it, you can expose it, and then you can start articulating alternatives.
Mm. Yeah, and we just wrote a piece about how important it is to listen, and it really does start with listening, because people will either say, well, they don't actually believe that. Well, actually, they do.
Yeah.
And you should listen to them, and our piece argued that you should listen to them and believe them, not believe the content of their speech, but believe that they believe it. Mm. And then once you do that, you can say, okay, now I have a much more clear understanding of this. In a professional context, the idea is the same. When you have to go to these trainings, just take really good notes and listen and really understand what it is, what is this ideology?
Once you really get it, then you can start speaking up, because you're coming from a place where you can't easily be shut down or refuted. So start paying attention. Look into what they're saying. Oh, well, this comes from this book. Go read that book. See what's there.
Well, that's been one of the great things of doing the show for us is we've educated ourselves on these issues. So when we get invited to write or speak about it, we are very comfortable that we actually know what we're talking about.
Right. That's key.
So speaking of which, did you like our book, How to Have Impossible Conversations?
Yes, we did. Very much so.
Yeah.
And we recommend that people get it.
Thanks. And yeah, definitely give them money.
We set all that up in advance, just recommending each other stuff. Listen, guys, the one question in the spirit of educating ourselves and having an opportunity for our audience to do the same is, we always like to give our guests an opportunity to talk about something that's left field. So the last question we ask, and we'll ask it of each of you separately, is, what is the one thing that we're not talking about that we should be talking about?
In the area of social justice?
In any area whatsoever.
Yeah. Anything in the whole world.
Anything in the whole world.
I mean, some people are talking about the thing that I would say. This isn't what anybody would expect. Nuclear power. There should be a lot more conversation about nuclear power. I hear all this stuff about renewables and green energy and, you know, great, you know. But there's so much resistance, especially from environmentalists, which is so strange, to nuclear power. I think we need lots more open-ended clear discussion that defers to the science. You've got to go, again, educate yourself a little bit. People need to get more clear on actually, in general, how safe and clean nuclear power is and how it actually is something implementable on large scale rather quickly. And if we're looking at environmental problems and taking them seriously, as I think we should, it's something that just keeps falling in this crack because everybody doesn't like to talk about nuclear. So you probably didn't expect that we are not talking enough about nuclear power, and we should be.
Well, it's one of the safest forms of energy, and I say this as someone whose wife grew up right next to Chernobyl. So yeah, it is very, very safe. What about you, Peter?
I'll throw you a curveball.
Yeah.
One of the best things I've done as a parent is I've placed my kids in an immersion program at the age of 3. So if somebody
has a language immersion
program. A language immersion program, right. Thanks, Mandarin. So if someone has a child, when I was in school, you got it in 7th, 8th, and 9th grade. That's way too late. Mm-hmm. It's got to be as young as possible so that they don't even know that they don't even have an awareness that they're learning it. So that's been a gift that's paid a remarkable dividend since I've done that. People thought I was insane too. Mm. But that's one thing I would suggest if someone's a parent is to put their kid as early as possible in an immersion program, language immersion.
And you've picked the right language as well. You're really future-proofing there with Mandarin, aren't you?
Well, you know, it was a good decision.
Let me add on my nuclear thing.
Yeah.
Nuclear boats. I don't remember what the number is of big tanker ships or carrier ships. Not like aircraft carriers, those are already nuclear. But, you know, cargo ships and cruise liners and things like that. I don't remember what the number is of the biggest ships that we run, but it's something like 7 equals in the amount of exhaust pollution that they put out from burning diesel is equal to all of cars on the planet or something like that. But boats are the easiest thing to put nuclear reactors in to drive them of pretty much anything. We already have all the technology. So not just even nuclear power, but nuclear powered vehicles. You know, all of our big scale sea transport can be done with nuclear power and cut down. If you're worried about atmospheric emissions, there are actually workable solutions if you just go nuclear.
You'll never win a Nobel Peace Prize with that kind of talk.
I should win a Nobel Peace Prize for my role in exposing the crap in the universities.
Yeah. Well, there you go. The campaign begins here. Well, listen, guys, thank you so much for coming on. We really appreciate your time and your thoughts. Follow both Peter and James on Twitter. They're very good. And if you do follow them, it's a very kind of mentally healthy contribution to your intake if you follow you guys. So we'll put the links in below. Get the book, How to Have Impossible Conversations. It's absolutely fantastic. And we will see you again in a week's time.
See you later, guys.
Before you go, consider joining our exclusive member feed. As a member, you'll get ad-free and extended interviews.
Click the membership link in the podcast description or find the exclusive episodes link on your podcast listening app to join us.